Okay, so this is Bio 160, and it is Thursday, November 6th. And we're kind of in the middle of the cardiovascular chapter. We might finish that up today, and then at the end of class, we got a short quiz on cardiovascular system, pretty much what we've covered already so far. So let's just kind of review a couple things. And let me pull out a picture of the heart right here. All right, so this is a nice exam figure. What part of the heart is this down here? Oh, it's not labeled. My goodness. That's the apex. All right, and then the base is up over here. And then we have some great vessels. Thank you so much. So we got some handouts for cardiovascular. It doesn't have the exam figures on it, but at least has the text slides if you need a copy. All right, then some of the great vessels coming off the base of the heart. And I tell you what, let's get oriented just a little bit. What chamber is this? Okay, a little slow to answer. Let's start by thinking, how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
How many valves does the heart have?
Four.
Just yell four. Four and four. All right, so don't forget, you got a left side of the heart, you got a right side of the heart. And so here is the left ventricle, right? Here are the two atria that are superior, the two ventricles that are inferior. The left ventricle pumps blood into the aorta. This is going to supply the systemic circulation. So this is oxygenated blood. It's already been oxygenated by the lungs. So we have a couple vessels branching off the aorta. And the first branch is the brachiocephalic. Brachio means going to the arm, and cephalic means going to the head. Brachiocephalic. And is that the right side or the left side?
Right.
That's the right side. That's exactly right. So brachiocephalic is on the right side. You have two corresponding arteries on the left side that do the job of the brachiocephalic. Those are the next two branches off the arch of the aorta, and that is the left common carotid, which is going to the head, and the left subclavian that is going to the left arm. So if we put the common carotid with the subclavian together, functionally you would get what? A brachiocephalic artery. All right, so this is, the aorta is supplying blood to the systemic circulation everywhere in your body, but we didn't say anything about the heart itself. The heart itself needs oxygen, right? It needs its own blood supply because the blood in the ventricles can't supply oxygen and nutrients to the myocardium itself. The myocardium is what? This middle layer of the heart that's actually contracting, doing all the work. So it needs its own blood supply. And you have a pretty good picture in your book that shows that. The arteries that supply blood to the heart originate right in this valve right here. This is a semilunar valve. And in particular, since it's attached to the aorta, that's the aortic semilunar valve. Within the cusps of this aortic semilunar valve, there are the origins of two arteries that feed blood to the heart itself. And those are what we call coronary arteries. So we can see the coronary arteries on this slide right here. So this is the aortic semilunar valve. Here is the aorta. And here is one coronary. Here is the other. There are only two that feed the whole heart. There's a right and a left. So here's the right one, and here is the left one over here. That supplies blood to the myocardium so that the heart can contract. And you might be wondering, all right, so that's the blood supply to the heart. What does it look like on the outside? Here's what the coronary arteries look like on the outside. So again, here is the apex, here's the base, this is the left side of the heart, here's the right side over here. So we see the right coronary coming off, that's about right where the aortic semilunar valve is. And the left coronary is coming off behind this pulmonary artery, so we can't quite see it, but we see some branches over here on the left side of the heart. So the left coronary and right coronary. Then the last question you might have is, well, how does blood get back to the heart? What chamber receives blood from the systemic circulation? Anybody know what chamber receives blood from the systemic circulation? You have a pretty good picture of the total circulation right here. Here's a nice picture of the whole circulation. I don't think I showed this to you last time, but kind of a similar figure. Remember, the left ventricle pumps blood into the aorta, which goes to the systemic circulation. So these are capillaries, for instance, in the upper half of your body and your brain. Or the aorta takes blood to the rest of your body. These are all systemic capillaries. In your abdominal pelvic area, your lower appendages are part of your systemic circulation. And notice, blood comes back to the heart via the superior vena cava and the inferior vena cava, and it empties into this chamber right here. So systemic circulation empties into the right, that's the right side of the heart, and is that a ventricle or an atrium? It's an atrium. So that shouldn't be too hard to see. So the right atrium receives blood from the systemic organs, including the heart. All right, so blood goes to the heart via the coronary arteries, and it comes back into the right atrium with the rest of the blood from your body. And you should know the name of that vessel. And the name of that vessel, we can see on this diagram right here. Now, how does this heart look compared to this one? Sort of looks backwards, right? All right, and that's because what did we do? We just turned the heart around, and now we're looking at the posterior side, the back side of the heart. So if we look at the back side, like looking from somebody's back, here we see a big, huge blood vessel right here, and it's blue because it carries deoxygenated blood. This is bringing blood from the heart itself back to the right atrium, and this thing we call the coronary sinus. So coronary arteries take blood to the heart. The coronary sinus brings blood back to the heart, and in particular, the right atrium over here. So that's really the only important thing that I want you to see on this diagram, except, you know what? We could practice labeling some of these vessels. Here is the aorta. What's the first branch off the aorta called again? Brachiocephalic. Yeah, brachiocephalic. All right, this is going to the right side of the body. What's the next branch? It's going to be the left common carotid going to the left side of the head, and then this is the left subclavian going to the left arm. All right, so that's just these right here, but turned around backwards. Superior and inferior vena cava, the superior and inferior vena cava bringing back systemic blood to the right atrium. Okay, so those I think are important vessels that you should be aware of. And what happens when there is a blockage of a coronary artery? Like maybe this one right here. It's coming off the left coronary and it descends down across the left ventricle. Sometimes we call this the left anterior descending artery, coronary artery. What happens if there's a blockage in this artery right here? What do we call that? That's what we call a heart attack. Okay, because blood can't get through that blockage. And then this segment of the myocardium, or this segment of the heart, can die as a result of that. And if it dies, then it's not going to pump blood, and that usually kills the individual as well, right? Unless it's a minor blockage, maybe causing a minor infarct in this area right here. A lot of times we catch blockages of these coronary arteries before they're completely occluded, right? So it just becomes compressed. We call that a stenosis. And that can be reduced by somebody placing a catheter into that blood vessel right there. And on the tip of that catheter is a little balloon, and you blow the balloon up, and it squishes that plaque down so the blood can flow through that area again. It's called coronary angioplasty, right? Because there's usually some fat in that artery right there, and we can kind of squish it out of the way. But a lot of times it has a tendency to recur. And then you have to be catheterized again and squish it out of the way once again. Okay. Other times these vessels are so damaged that they actually have to be replaced with a graft from some other part of your body. All right, that's a much more extensive kind of surgery. Because an angioplasty, when they just put a balloon here to blow it up, to squish that blood vessel back open, you don't have to open up somebody's chest to do that. You can get to this vessel just by threading a catheter all the way up from somebody's leg. Okay, from their thigh all the way around up into this area right here. So it's a little bit easier kind of technique. But I wouldn't volunteer for it just for fun. Okay. So remember, we have two sides of the heart. We've got the left side and the right side. And that's because how many circulations are there in the body? And what are they? What are the circulations in the body? You've got the systemic circulation and the pulmonary circulation. The systemic circulation is taking oxygen to the tissues and picking up CO2. The pulmonary circulation is taking CO2 to the lungs where it's given off, and it's picking up oxygen, right? And that brings it back to the left side of the heart, and then the left side of the heart pumps it through the systemic circulation. All right, what else did we cover last time? I think we talked about how the heart pumps. It's not like an electric motor that's spinning around constantly pumping. There are some times when the heart is contracting, that's when it's pumping blood. Other times the heart is relaxing, that's when it's filling. So sometimes the heart is pumping, sometimes it's filling. So we call that the cardiac cycle. And it has those two phases. What do we call those two phases? Let's start with the phase when the heart is actually contracting. That's called systole, yeah? And when the heart is relaxing, filling with blood, we call that diastole, systole and diastole, and they follow each other, okay? And don't forget, the heart can't pump blood until it relaxes and fills with blood. So that's just as an important phase as contraction itself. And what's a good normal blood pressure to have? 120 over 80. That's systolic pressure, when the heart contracts, maximal pressure, and diastolic, that 80 number, is when the heart is relaxing. Okay. So the heart is pretty interesting because if we were to take a heart out of some animal, including a person, and put it in a bowl, it would actually contract all by itself. It doesn't need to be connected up to a nervous system to know when to contract. The heart contracts all on its own. What the nerves, when it goes to the heart, what the nerves do, it just adjusts the rate. It can speed the heart up or it can slow it down. It can adjust the force of contraction, right? But the heart by itself knows when to contract. And that's because it has its own electrical activity. So just like a nerve, remember when we looked at an action potential, there are two parts to an action potential. There is depolarization, which is the first part. And what's the second part? Repolarization. So there are some parts of the heart that actually act like nerve fibers. They're really muscle fibers, but they're not specialized to contract like most muscles. They're specialized to transmit electrical impulses or action potentials. And we call those specialized muscle cells the conduction system of the heart. So these are really important because if you have a heart attack, which includes some part of this conduction system, so not only is your heart not going to contract, it won't even know when to contract because the conduction system is all messed up. So here are some structures of the conduction system, and let's just take a look at a picture right away. I'll go over these different structures and where they are located. So here's another nice section of the heart, kind of a coronal section. So here you got what? Apex. Here you got the base. Over here is the left ventricle. Here is the right ventricle, right atrium. And what's this here? The left atrium. Yeah, left atrium, left ventricle. Oh, plus you got to know these valves. These valves are between an atrium and a ventricle. So what's a general name for this valve between an atrium and a ventricle? That's an atrioventricular valve. And then specifically, which one is this on the left side of the heart? That's the bicuspid or mitral valve. I've heard both. Both of you guys are right. And this one over here is the tricuspid. Yeah, tri before bi. Okay. Well, these little yellow lines right here represent the conduction system of the heart. And where the heart learns, or the part of the heart that tells the heart when to contract, we call that the pacemaker. That determines the overall rhythm of the heart. And the pacemaker is right here. We call this the sinoatrial node because it's near an atrium right here. And this area depolarizes at its own rhythm very rapidly compared to other parts of the heart. And one of the characteristics of cardiac tissue is that electrical signals can go directly from one cell to another cell to another cell. If you want to go back and look at your histology chapter, you'll see that there are special little discs between the myocardial cells. We call those intercalated discs, and they allow for direct electrical contact between the cells. So when one cell depolarizes, that depolarization can flow over the whole heart, causing the heart to contract as a single unit. That's not so with skeletal muscle. And is that kind of obvious why? It's a good thing skeletal muscle doesn't have electrical connections between cells. Because what would happen if you were to just stimulate one cell in your biceps, and if that cell was connected electrically to all the muscle cells in your body, what would happen when you would tell that one biceps muscle to contract very weakly? What would happen to all the muscles in your body? They would contract. Right, so you reach out to pick up a pen, and what would happen? Your whole body would contract. You could never grab that pen because you would be contracted all the time. All right, so that works for the heart because the heart should contract as a unit, but your whole body never contracts as a unit, right? Only parts at a time that you want to control. So the sinoatrial node is what we call the pacemaker of the heart, and it's in the right atrium, the superior part of the right atrium. And then there are some tiny fibers, pathways, that this electrical signal can follow to flow over both atria. All right, and then that electrical signal is going to cause the atria to contract. So the electrical signal precedes contraction by just a little bit, a couple milliseconds, just fractions of a second. Okay, and between the atria and the ventricles, you have these valves, but you also have a lot of fibrous tissue that can't conduct electrical signals. And your book has a picture of what that fibrous skeleton of the heart looks like. Here it is right here. All right, so we see a bunch of fibers, which aren't muscle. That fibrous skeleton attaches all of the heart valves to it, so it's very tough. But it also doesn't conduct electricity. So electricity can't go automatically from the atrium into the ventricles. There has to be a special pathway. There are no special pathways in the atria right here. They function together electrically. And when a tissue, when thousands or millions of cells work together, function together, we call that a syncytium. Has anybody seen that word before, syncytium? All right, I think that was one of the things, one of the questions in the student study guide, a syncytium. Huh?
Is that how you say it?
Syncytium. Yeah, that's how you say it. Syncytium. S-Y-N something, something, something. So the atria act as a syncytium because the electrical signal from the SA node can flow over both atria, no problem. So as long as it's a healthy heart. If it's damaged, then that won't happen. All right, and then that causes the atria to contract. But we said that electrical signal can't get into the ventricles because of all the connective tissue between the atria and the ventricles, except that there is one special way. There's a special pathway. And that special pathway starts with the atrioventricular node. What's another name for the atrioventricular node? You're going to call that the AV node. Atrioventricular node. And the AV node holds on to the electrical signal for just a little bit, delays the signal, and then it gives it to what we call the atrioventricular bundle right here. And now it goes into the ventricles. What part of the ventricle is this? The wall between the right and left ventricle. What is that called? That's a septum, right? Interventricular septum. The electrical signal goes into the interventricular septum, and then it branches. It bifurcates into two pathways. Here's the left bundle branch. Over here is the right bundle branch. The electrical signal goes very quickly all the way down to the apex of the heart. And there it starts to stimulate a bunch of muscle fibers. And then it flows back up the free wall of the ventricles into these little fibers that we call Purkinje fibers. And the Purkinje fibers stimulate the muscle cells into contracting. So this is the whole conduction system of the heart. You've got the SA node, which is the pacemaker. The AV node is the doorway that that electrical signal has to use to get into the ventricles. And then you got the bundle branches and the Purkinje fibers that stimulate the rest of the heart to contract. Okay, so you might see from that discussion that the heart contracts in a very special kind of way. And that is, which chambers contract first? Do the atria contract first, or do the ventricles, or do they contract at the same time? And that has some important implications. Well, here's the SA node. This is where depolarization starts. That signals contraction. That causes contraction of the atria first. So what does that do? When the atria contracts, what happens to blood? It gets pushed into the ventricles. So that helps fill the ventricles, because you got to have blood in there before the ventricles contract. If there's no blood in the ventricles when they contract, it's not going to pump any blood out. So the beauty of this system is that the atria contract first, helping fill the ventricles up. And then the ventricles contract. Now, how do the ventricles contract? Well, that wave of depolarization goes very fast down the AV bundle, through the bundle branches, and finally into these Purkinje fibers. So it's the apical region of the ventricles that actually contract first. So they start to contract, and which way does that force blood? It forces it up out of the heart, because that's where the great vessels are. So let me see if I can show you on this particular slide. Okay, so if the ventricles contracted before the atria, they wouldn't fill up with as much blood. All right, so atria contract first, and then the ventricles. And then don't forget, the blood is ejected out of what? The basal regions of the heart, not the apical region. So what would happen if the more basal regions of the ventricles contracted first before the apex down here? Which way would blood be pushed? Right? If this part of the heart were to contract, if the basal regions of the heart were to contract first, that would force blood inferiorly into the apex. And where can it go once it's in the apex? You know what? It can't go anywhere because it's trapped. So the best way for the heart to pump blood is from the apex, squish, 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 up out of the heart through these vessels near the base of the heart. Okay? And so it's the job of that conduction system to make sure that atria contract first, and then the apical regions forcing blood up out of the heart in this direction. Okay, so you got to know the sequence of these, how the heart is stimulated from these different electrical fibers. The first one is the pacemaker. What's another name for a pacemaker? SA node, right? And then the AV node. And then the AV bundle. Sometimes we call that the bundle of His. That's a guy's name, capital H-I-S. Probably a guy. I don't know for sure. And then the left and right bundle branches, and then that's going to cause depolarization of the Purkinje fibers right here. Okay. All right, so we named these valves right here. Let's just review a couple other things. What are these fibers called? Chordae tendineae. And a chordae tendineae, you can always tell, is because it connects an atrioventricular valve with this little muscle right here. What are these little muscles called? These are papillary muscles. Did you have to know papillary muscle? I would guess so. Yeah. Okay. Notice there are a bunch of other little muscles in the ventricles. Those aren't papillary muscles. They might be easy to confuse. But a papillary muscle is always going to have chordae tendineae attached to them. So if you see a muscle in the heart, and if it's not attached to chordae tendineae, it's not a papillary muscle. It's a different kind. Anybody know what that different kind of little muscle is inside the heart? I'm sure that's something you don't have to know in here. But let me see if I can find the exam figure. Let's just double check real quick. It's called trabeculae carni. You see anything like trabeculae carni on here? Sure don't. You just see papillary muscles. But these other little muscles right in here, those are trabeculae. If you ever take another anatomy class, you'll have to know that. So you don't have to memorize it for this one, but maybe just remember that you've heard it someplace. All right, so that's the conduction system of the heart. So here are the pieces: the sinoatrial node, atrioventricular node, the bundle of His, which is the same thing as what? The AV bundle. And then the Purkinje fibers. All right. Well, the heart is a fairly large organ, and when it depolarizes, it produces a lot of electrical activity. And that electrical activity, we can actually monitor on the surface of our body. So we can put electrodes on the surface of our body and measure the electrical activity of the heart. And does anybody know what the electrical activity, when we measure the electrical activity of the heart and get a tracing of it, what that's called? Electrocardiogram. That's right. So sometimes we say ECG. What else can we say? EKG. They're exactly the same thing. Okay, so electrocardiogram, cardio with a C, or electrocardio with a K. And whenever you see a K, I think it's just because it came from Europe. That's a very old way of spelling it, probably a German way. They might spell it that way in France too, I'm not sure. But that's just an old European way of spelling myocardium or cardiac muscle, okay, with a K. They're exactly the same. And if you're ever in a hospital following signs to get to the ECG department, guess what? In one hallway, it might be labeled ECG. And the next hallway, it might be labeled EKG. Okay, so there's no agreement on how to spell it. Either way works, and it means exactly the same thing. Okay, so what does this ECG looks like? And I'll say ECG, EKG interchangeably as well. Okay. Here's a pretty good picture that's in your book. All right, so this is how the electrical signal moves through the heart. Starts with the SA node, moves through the atrial syncytium, all right, and then to the atrioventricular node, into the AV bundle, down the bundle branches to the Purkinje fibers, and then that spreads through both ventricles through the ventricular syncytium, because the ventricles all work together. All right, so let's see if I can find that ECG. Yeah, here's an ECG. All right, so here is an electrocardiogram. So this is a measure of the electricity from where? The heart, right? So that's why they say cardiogram. A gram is just some kind of note. So this is usually put on a piece of paper, so it looks like a note or a picture. And it's electro. We say electro, why? Because we're actually measuring, what does that say? Volts. Yeah, millivolts. We are actually measuring volts, but little tiny volts. So they're millivolts, right? Electrical activity on the heart. So this is a graph or a gram plot of voltage versus time. So again, instead of seconds or hours, we have milliseconds, a short period of time, because it happens pretty fast. All right, so here is 0 volts, and we see that it's not just a flat line, which is really good if you're alive, right? So these things we call waves. These deviations in the electrocardiogram we call waves. And here's the first one. This is what we call the primavera wave. I don't know if that's how they named it, but that's easy to remember, which means what? That's the first wave. Okay, here's the first wave. And what happens first in the heart? Where is there electrical activity first in the heart? In the atrium. That's right. Okay, and in particular, the sinoatrial node, and both atria depolarize very rapidly. So this wave right here, or the P wave, is depolarization of the atria. So you could write that in, depolarization of the atria. And then that signal goes to the AV node. And what does the AV node do? It holds on to that signal for a little while. It delays that signal. So here, nothing is happening. You see just a flat line between the P wave and the Q wave right here, because that's where the AV node is just holding on to the signal, allowing for the atria to contract. And then the signal moves very rapidly through the AV bundle, down through the septum, stimulating the whole heart, the rest of the ventricles, to depolarize. So here we have a QRS wave that represents ventricular depolarization. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to abbreviate. AD, atrial depolarization. The QRS complex, made up of these three different waves, this is called VD, ventricular depolarization. And ventricular depolarization is going to signal the ventricles to contract and then pump blood. Okay, so what happens after depolarization? There's an electrical event, which we call repolarization. There are potassium ions that move. There are potassium currents. So we call that repolarization, and we have one last wave right here on the ECG. That's the T wave. This is due to ventricular repolarization, VR. All right, so what are some things that I notice? Well, depolarization precedes repolarization, and atrial depolarization is really small compared to ventricular depolarization. Why is that? Why is the QRS complex so big compared to the P wave? Okay, because it's just the beginning? That's a pretty good reason. But let's look at the size of those two different compartments. How thick is the wall of the atrium compared to the wall of the ventricle over here? It's really, really thin, right? So the atria contain very few cells compared to the massive numbers of cells that are in the ventricles. And so when you have more cells, for instance, in the ventricles, it just produces a much bigger electrical signal because there are just more cells right there. Millions more cells because the wall of the ventricle is a lot thicker. So when the ventricles depolarizes, it produces a much bigger signal. It's easier to see compared to a small signal that we get from the atria because the walls are so thin. All right, so that's why the QRS is so big. There's another reason why, and that is the T wave is due to what kind of electrical event inside the heart? Repolarization. Now, do you see on here anywhere where I wrote down atrial repolarization? Nope, you haven't seen it yet. And the reason why is because, well, the atria have to repolarize, because you see them depolarize right here. They repolarize the same time that the ventricles depolarize. So in this region right here, it's really due to two things. The important thing is depolarization of the ventricles plus, the atrial repolarization. It's due to those two things. But atrial repolarization is so small that it's really hard to pick out. We can't really pick it out. We can't separate it. The QRS complex represents both of these things together. There's really no way to separate them. And that's because the atria are so small, has very few cells compared to the massive number of cells that are in the ventricles. And this is what a normal ECG looks like, right here. And sometimes, I don't have a picture. Sometimes, for instance, let me get a picture of a heart, just a heart. Okay, so we see, that's a pretty good picture, but let me find one that has the conduction system on it. Where's the one with the conduction system? Close. Right here. Okay, so don't forget, the way the conduction system works is what? SA node, AV node, then all the atria contract, and then the electrical signal goes down the septum through the AV bundle and the bundle branches, and then causes the ventricles to depolarize. So the signal has a very nice ordered flow to it. SA node, atria, then ventricles. SA node, atria, and then ventricles. But remember, each one of these cells can conduct electricity. So there really is nothing stopping the heart from producing an electrical signal here and then having this electrical signal just kind of wander around inside the heart. Okay, and when it gets up over here, then it might wander around back down over here. And if it moves in this little line, then it's going to cause this part of the heart to contract, right? And then this part over here, and then this part over here, and then finally work its way back down. And when that happens, you should try to have a picture in your mind what the contraction of the heart looks like. Okay, instead of pumping altogether, the heart is just going to quiver. The apex is going to contract, and then the base, and then the middle part, and then the apex again. And when the heart is quivering, how much blood is it pumping? It's not pumping hardly any at all. Okay, and so that's very deadly. We call that ventricular fibrillation. So the coordination of the contraction of the heart is lost, and the heart doesn't pump blood. The muscles are still contracting, but not in a coordinated way. And the heart stops pumping blood, and when that happens, how many seconds of consciousness do you have? Yeah, about 3 seconds, 4 seconds, somewhere in there. And if we don't stop that fibrillation, when does your brain actually die? 3 to 4 minutes after that, right? So ventricular fibrillation is very, very lethal, and you need to get somebody out of that rhythm very quickly. And in a hospital, that's not such a big deal. Usually somebody's around that can get to you in about 3 or 4 minutes, but there's no way, for instance, if somebody were to go into ventricular fibrillation here in the room, that we could get you to the hospital within 3 minutes. Okay, but what could we do for you? Okay, a couple things. Somebody said get a defibrillator. I think there are a couple automatic defibrillators on campus, but I don't know where they are. Huh? Does anybody know where they are? No? I don't know. Yeah? In the weightlift, that's a good place to have one, yeah. Actually, because that stresses the heart, that would be an area where somebody might go into fibrillation. Because when you're lifting weights, you're also holding your breath, working strenuously, that could affect your heart. Okay, but there's something else. If you don't have that nice technology, I'll talk about what a defibrillator does in just a second. But what else can we do for somebody that's in ventricular fibrillation? CPR, right. We can do chest compressions, which pressurizes their heart, and that helps pump blood, even though their heart is acting really strange. And that just gives enough blood to your brain to keep you alive until you find your way to the ER, and they can defibrillate you there. So what does defibrillation do? Yeah, it does. It produces this big electrical shock. We put electrodes on somebody's chest, okay, and that produces a big electrical shock. And what does that do to muscle? It causes muscles to contract. All your skeletal muscles contract, but it also contracts the heart. Instead of the heart fibrillating, you know, or just quivering, it causes the whole heart to contract at once. And then, if everything goes correctly and you're lucky, the heart goes back into a normal rhythm instead of just sitting there quivering. All right, when the heart is sitting there quivering, that's really dangerous because the muscles are contracting, using up energy. It's depleting the energy in the heart, and the longer that goes on, the more and more damage it does to the heart. Okay, so, and people can get fibrillation in the atria here. That's not necessarily as dangerous as the ventricles, because the ventricles still might be pumping blood. But you still need to deal with that. If the atria are fibrillating, they're not pumping blood as much, so you have a lot of blood standing still in the atria, and whenever blood stands still, guess what it has a tendency to do? It has a tendency to clot, to form a clot, and then the clot goes through your circulatory system, maybe causing a stroke or a heart attack or something like that. So a defibrillator stops what we call these circus rhythms or circus currents in the heart, and it forces the heart to go back to what? Sinoatrial node, AV node, down the AV bundle branches to the Purkinje fibers, causing what? The atria to contract, then the ventricles, atria, and then the ventricles, if all goes well. Yeah.
So that's why I have a defibrillator, because I have a problem with the bottom chambers.
These ventricles right here?
Yeah. You're not able to ablate it, like burn it off.
Okay.
But they said that in the top chamber you could burn it off, but I had to get a defibrillator because it was in the bottom, and it hurt like real bad. Like when it shocks you, it shocks like every 15 seconds until it slows down.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it gives like, it goes like 30 joules, 20.
Oh, it steps up the voltage.
Yeah, so it goes 20, 30,
and then you have
40,
your fingers crossed hoping it will start sooner rather than later. Because you can probably feel the difference in charge.
Yeah, but after 3 shocks, you could go into cardiac arrest.
Okay. Yeah, so that's a real serious condition, but that's a really nice piece of technology to have because it saves your life. But it's probably pretty uncomfortable,
yeah,
to feel that. So that's the ventricles down over here. Sometimes when people have atrial fibrillation, we like to shock their heart as well to get it back into a normal rhythm. But when somebody's in atrial fibrillation, they're conscious, just like you're conscious when it shocks those ventricles, and it's pretty uncomfortable. Okay? Sometimes you might put some anesthetic on somebody's chest before you shock them, but they feel that shock. And a lot of times You might have to shock somebody maybe 5 or 6 times in the course of an evening. All right, so sometimes in an emergency room you might hear somebody yelling, "No, no, don't shock me." But you have to, because otherwise what might happen to the person? They might die, right?
So,
these cardiac problems, that's too bad when you have those. Okay, so what do you got to know about the ECG? The P wave, what's happening during the P wave, that's the first one. The QRS, that's depolarization of the ventricles as well as repolarization of the atria. The T wave is ventricular repolarization. And then fibrillation is when you have no characteristic waveforms. And what that looks like, you've probably seen it on TV. What is an electrocardiogram? What are we going to plot out? We're going to plot voltage, right? Which the heart is generating. The heart is generating that voltage. And what's the horizontal axis right here? This is time, right? And when somebody's in ventricular fibrillation, instead of any kind of discernible waves, it just looks like all this random stuff over here. Okay? So the electrical activity of the heart is still there, but it's no longer coordinated. Yeah, when it shocks you, it goes way up because you're using a huge voltage. It would go up to the back wall and back down. Okay? Okay, and so an automatic electronic defibrillator can actually look at this waveform and tell that there are no P waves or QRSs there, because you don't ever want to really shock somebody that's in a normal sinus rhythm. Because if you shock somebody's heart and they're in this kind of rhythm, that can actually force them into this condition here, right? And this is the deadly condition. So the automatic electronic defibrillator is pretty smart. It knows if it should shock you or not. So that's why they're kind of new. They have to have a computer in there to make that diagnosis. Okay. You can even dial up over the phone lines now and transmit the data.
Email.
Oh, and then somebody in the hospital reads the ECG.
It goes to the phone line, and it sends an email, and they can change the.
Oh, they can adjust your pacemaker.
Over the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have to put something up to your heart to change that.
It's like a mouse.
Just a little mouse, little thing. Yeah, it works by magnets probably.
Yeah.
Okay, so does your heart make any noise?
Yes,
what do we call those noises? We call those heart sounds, right? So let's talk about some heart sounds. All right, so when your heart contracts, remember I said it beats very forcefully, almost violently inside your chest. Oh, you know what? There's something else I wanted to mention. Let's see if I have a picture, overall location of the heart. You know? Okay, what cavity is the heart in? What part of your, this is good. I see it right here. All right, so here we have lungs, here we have the diaphragm. What cavity is this right here called? That's close. But the cavity that the lungs are into? Thoracic cavity, right? So the thoracic cavity is just this whole big, huge cavity right here that's superior to the diaphragm. That's the thoracic cavity. And then we can break the thoracic cavity down into some smaller cavities. What are the small cavities that the lungs are in? What's that word that if you ever hear it, you think of lungs? It is pleural cavities. Maybe we didn't talk about it. I think we did the very first chapter, right? The right and left pleural cavities. Those are subcavities of the thoracic cavity. And the pleural cavities are separated by another one, which is where the heart is located. And that's what you told me. And that's actually what I'm interested in knowing. What is the cavity that the heart is in? You could say thoracic cavity, but let's say the cavity that the heart is in all by itself. That is the mediastinum, right? So you were right when you said mediastinum, but I wanted to work up to it. Mediastinum separates the right and left pleural cavities, and all of those are inside what? The thoracic cavity. Yeah, I forgot to mention that. Okay, so heart sounds. Your heart does make noise because it's beating actually fairly violently, generating a lot of pressure in blood. And it even bounces up against your thoracic wall. What's that point where the apex pounds up against your chest wall? What's that called? Anybody remember? That's called the PMI, point of maximal impulse. Okay. And what are those things that keep blood flowing in one direction through the heart called? The valves, that's right. So sometimes the valves are open, sometimes they close. And when the valves close, they slam close really hard, all right? And that's what makes heart sounds. So let's see if we can figure out where these heart sounds are coming from. So you've got a pretty good slide that shows this. So heart sounds originate from closing of the valves. Here's a pretty good picture. Maybe I need this one too. Let's take a look at this. All right, so here we see the heart, the left side of the heart, the right side of the heart. So we got the two atria, the two ventricles. And in this particular case, we see that these semilunar valves are closed and the atrioventricular valves are open. So when the atrioventricular valves are open, blood can flow from an atrium into the ventricle. Now, in terms of pressure, why is it that blood can flow from an atrium into a ventricle under these conditions? Which chamber has a higher pressure? The atria or the ventricle? Okay, because how does a fluid always flow? It always flows, just like diffusion, from high to low. All right, so there's high pressure in the atrium and low in the ventricle. All right, and then here is the aorta. And the aorta usually always has high pressure in it. So which way is blood going to want to flow when the heart is relaxed? If the aorta has high pressure and it's low in the ventricle, it's going to want to flow from the aorta back into the ventricle. But what's preventing that from happening? See that aortic valve right there? It's closed, so it can't flow back. It wants to, but it won't because that aortic valve is closed. Okay, so this is where we're going to start. All right, so now the ventricle here fills up with blood. It fills up with blood and then it starts to contract. So now the pressure inside the left ventricle becomes a lot higher than the atrium. So which way does blood want to flow now? Okay, if it's high in the ventricle and low in the atrium, it wants to flow back. But what's going to stop it from flowing backwards? That atrioventricular valve. So as soon as pressure in the ventricle is higher than the atria, that valve closes, and guess what happens? You hear a sound, the closing of that valve. It just goes bang, it closes. Okay, so when does that atrioventricular valve close? When the ventricle is in what we call systole, when it starts to contract. So let's look. The ventricle is contracting right here, and the atrioventricular valve is closed. When pressure is high in the ventricle, when the ventricle is in systole, the pressure is higher here compared to the aorta, and so it's going to force the semilunar valves open, and blood can flow out, which is a good thing. All right, well, what follows contraction of the ventricles? What happens after the ventricles contract? Okay, yeah, the ventricles relax so it can fill up with blood again. What happens to the pressure inside this left ventricle when it starts to relax? It goes back down again. Right, so now when the ventricles relax, you have high pressure in the aorta, low pressure in the ventricle. Which way does blood want to flow now? Back from the aorta into the ventricle, but can it? No, because the semilunar valve here is going to slam closed. Right, so you have two valves that are making noise. You got the atrioventricular valves during ventricular systole, and then you have the semilunar valves that close during diastole, when the ventricles relax. So those are the two heart sounds that we get. Where's that at? That's... Oh, it is right here. Okay, so there are two heart sounds. The first one is when the atrioventricular valve closes. That AV valve closes during when? Ventricular systole. You see ventricular systole right here? It's contracting. And look at that AV valve. is closed because blood is going to try to squirt back up into the atrium, but that atrioventricular valve prevents it from happening. That's the first heart sound during ventricular systole. The second heart sound happens when the aortic and pulmonary semilunar valves close. And when do these valves close? When the heart starts to relax or going into diastole, blood is going to try to flow back from the aorta into the left ventricle or back from the pulmonary artery back into the right ventricle right here. Then this pulmonary semilunar valve is going to close. So those are the two heart sounds. There can be other sounds in the heart. Maybe you might hear a squishing sound or a swirling sound or a swooshing kind of sound. And that happens when these valves don't open properly or close properly. They leak a little bit. Have you ever had a balloon and the mouth of the balloon was kind of half open, half closed, and you let some of the air come out of the balloon? What kind of sound did it make? Like a little squeaking sound? Okay? And that's what these valves might sound like. Okay? They're going to make a little squeaking sound if blood is squeaking past, if they don't close completely. So murmurs are due to what we call insufficient valves. They don't close completely, or incompetent valves. Insufficient or incompetent means that they don't close properly and they make that squishing sound. Other valves are what we call stenotic, meaning that they don't open all the way. They might close all the way, but if they don't open all the way, it can also make a funny sound as blood is squeaking past these valves that aren't opening all the way. That's a stenotic valve. Okay, so that's a lot about the heart. What about regulation of the heart? Let's talk about that for a second. There are two different ways the heart is controlled. There are intrinsic mechanisms and extrinsic mechanisms. Intrinsic means that it's a mechanism that occurs inside the heart itself. The heart doesn't need any outside influence. It's all internal to the heart. So intrinsic means internal. Extrinsic mechanisms mean that it requires something that is outside the heart. Intrinsic is internal. Extrinsic means outside. And in order to understand how the heart is regulated, we got to know something about cardiac output. And cardiac output is just how much blood the heart pumps. All right, so what do you know about the heart? If you want to measure something about your heart, what could you measure? Without any kind of fancy instruments at all, what could you measure? Something about your heart. Yeah, your pulse. You could measure your heart rate, right? By palpating pressure maybe in your radial artery or up in your carotid artery in your neck, you could get heart rate. So the amount of blood that's pumped by the heart is determined by the heart rate. The faster your heart rate, the more blood your heart pumps. But also there's something else too, and that is not just your rate, but when the heart contracts every time, how much blood the heart pumps out every time it contracts. And that's what we call the stroke volume. So if we multiply the stroke volume times the heart rate, that gives us the cardiac output, the total flow of blood out of your heart for every minute. So stroke volume is measured in a volume per beat. A volume is measured in milliliters right here. And your heart rate is measured in what? Beats per minute. And if we multiply these two things together, we can see something cancels out. What cancels out? If we look at the dimensions of these numbers, yeah, the beat cancels because there's a beat here in the denominator. There's a beat here in the numerator. These cancel out. And what are you left with? Milliliters per minute. That's what cardiac output is, right? Milliliters per minute. So your cardiac output is regulated. Let's see how it can be regulated. All right, do you have a slide that looks like this? Probably. No? Yeah, good. Okay, let's fill it in. All right, so your body is going to measure blood pressure because you have pressure sensors in some arteries that are in the neck. We haven't looked at these arteries yet. And so let's just say... All right, let's just say that there is a decrease in blood pressure. So for instance, right now you're sitting down, and as soon as you stand up, your blood pressure is going to drop. When you change body position, your blood pressure drops. Maybe you don't have, do you have that or not?
No.
Oh, you don't have that. Okay, well I'm glad I asked.
Which is
You got that one. Okay. Let's look at this one. Let's look at this one right here. Intrinsic regulation of the heart. Let's talk about that one first. Okay. And this is what we call Starling's Law of the Heart. Starling's Law of the Heart just says, okay, let's plot out myocardial contractility, which is force of contraction of the heart, versus how we stretch the heart out, or myocardial stretch. When does the heart stretch out? Is the heart stretching when it's contracting, or when it's filling up with blood? Think of like when you fill up a balloon. What's happening to the balloon? Is it stretching when you let the air out, or when you blow it up? When you blow it up, right? Okay, so as the heart fills with more blood, right, we're going to see that the heart gets stronger. So as the heart fills up with blood, it starts to stretch. And the muscles themselves actually get stronger when that happens. So myocardial contractility increases. Right? And then after a certain point, okay, well, let's just leave it like that. Okay? So this is Frank Starling, or not Frank Starling, but it is Frank Starling, but just call it Starling's Law of the Heart. You don't have to worry about Frank, his first name. Okay. All right, so as the heart fills with blood, the heart gets stronger and stronger. So that just says that as blood is presented to the heart gets more efficient at pumping it out. And that's just, all that has to do is with the arrangement of the myofibrils inside the heart. Can anybody remember what the myofibrils are? What's a myofibril in muscle? What are some myofibrils? They're like actin and myosin. And how are they arranged with each other? They interdigitate each other, right? Okay. And so that's due to the overlap of actin and myosin within the heart. If the heart isn't stretched out, okay, the actin and myosin is all overlapped, right? And if actin and myosin is overlapped, then the actin and myosin can't slide past each other anymore because they're already slid past each other as far as they can be, right? So what happens now if we start to stretch the heart and we separate the actin and myosin a little bit, we pull them apart, now what happens when they get a signal to contract? They can slide a little bit, right? So there is room for them to slide over each other. If the heart isn't stretched, the actin and myosin are maximally overlapped. They can't come, the Z lines of a sarcomere can't come together anymore. But as soon as we start stretching the heart, now actin and myosin can slide past each other a little bit. So that's just a property of the heart. So let's just say, let's increase cardiac filling. So if we increase, if we start to fill the heart, what happens to the stretch of the heart? Does it increase or decrease? It increases, right? So we increase filling of the heart, that increases the stretch. What about contractility of the heart? As we start to separate the Z lines, what happens to contractility? Now the myosin and actin have room to slide, right? And the heart can generate some force to pump blood. So that increases myocardial contractility just due to cardiac filling. And as cardiac contractility increases, how does that affect how much blood the heart can pump out every time it contracts? That increases as well, right? So increased myocardial contractility increases stroke volume. And if stroke volume increases, where's my little diagram right here? If stroke volume increases, what happens to cardiac output and why? Don't forget, cardiac output is what we say directly related to stroke volume and heart rate. And the stroke volume increases, what happens to cardiac output? That has to increase as well. Okay? So as the heart stretches, cardiac output increases. That's just the Starling law of the heart because of the overlap of actin and myosin. Okay, so let's look at these two markers that I have. Right, in order for the heart to contract, the actin and myosin can't be overlapped exactly. They have to be offset from each other so that they can slide past each other. If they're exactly lined up, they can't slide, right? They can't shorten the sarcomere. Right, so that's why the Frank Starling law says the contractility of the heart increases as we start to stretch the heart. Now, what happens if we really stretch the heart? If we overstretch the heart, what about the overlap of actin and myosin now that we've really stretched the heart out? Can the heart contract? No, because the actin and myosin have to be able to form cross bridges between them. Right? So if we overstress the heart or stretch the heart, the contractility goes down. So let's take a look at this bottom graph right here. So draw another axis, myocardial contractility versus stretch. The Frank-Starling curve is actually going to look like something like this. All right, I just drew what we call the ascending limb of the Starling law of the heart. This is the descending limb. All right, so let's look at two conditions. Hemorrhage, right here. What is hemorrhage? That's blood loss, right? That's when you lacerate yourself, cut a blood vessel. A lot of blood leaves your body. And if that blood is not in your blood vessel someplace, is it getting back to the heart? No, it's lying out on the ground someplace, right? So if blood is not going back to your heart, what can you tell me about the stretch of the ventricle? Is the stretch of the ventricle increasing or decreasing when you're losing a lot of blood? It's decreasing, right? Blood is not going back to the heart. It's not expanding the heart. It's not stretching the heart. So during hemorrhage right here, we're on the descending limb of the Starling curve. So the really unfortunate thing about when somebody's in a really bad accident and they lose blood, what happens to the strength of their heart? Does it stay the same? It actually decreases. So when they lose blood, their heart gets weaker and weaker and weaker, which is the worst thing that could possibly happen. Right? So when somebody has a hemorrhage, what do we like to do for them right away? Stopping from bleeding, because we don't want them to lose any more blood. But how can we get the heart? How can we get the heart to come back strong again? Put something back in their blood, right? So even if you don't have blood, what do we like to do? Even just put fluid back in, right? Just hook them up to some Ringer solution or something, which is what, an IV fluid. That fluid goes into their blood, their circulatory system, and so now what? That fluid goes back to their heart, and what does it do to the heart? Starts to stretch it. Stretches the heart, what happens to the force of contraction now? Just because you're stretching the heart, it gets stronger as a result of that. So just by giving them IV fluids, our heart gets stronger and stronger, right, because of the Starling law of the heart right here. Okay. Huh? Eventually you're going to need blood, depending on how much you lost. Hopefully you didn't lose so much, you can build it back yourself. But you might need a transfusion. Okay, how tricky is a transfusion reaction? Can you get blood from anybody?
No.
No, you got to do what? You got to cross match it, right? You got to get that ABO system work just fine, okay? Because it's an antibody antigen reaction. You don't want to agglutinate anybody's blood. All right, well, let's talk about this overload condition right here. Sometimes, okay, people retain way too much fluid in their body. And if they retain fluid in their circulatory system, you have more blood going back to the heart. And when you have exceptional levels, above normal levels of blood going back to the heart, what can you tell me about the heart? Does it stretch more or less?
More.
It stretches more. And what can you tell me about actin and myosin as the heart stretches more? It loses the overlap between actin and myosin, and now the heart can't contract because it's getting too stressed out, too stretched. All right, so we call that a fluid overload condition. So when people retain fluid, their heart gets weaker and weaker and weaker because they're retaining fluid. What can we do to somebody in that condition? We don't really want to, like, stab them and let blood out, but we'd like to get rid of that fluid by giving them a diuretic, for instance. And you might know some people that are on Lasix, okay? But people that are in fluid overload, heart failure, we make them pee a lot, right? They go to the bathroom, they pee a lot. That decreases their blood volume. It stops their heart from being so stretched out. It goes back to normal. What happens to the force of contraction of the heart? It goes back up, right? And we can, under most circumstances, prevent heart failure from doing that, from occurring, if we prevent that fluid overload. So the Starling law of the heart is pretty important to know how to manipulate it, right, day in and day out for patients. Okay. So what do I want to talk about next? Extrinsic regulation. I think, you know what? I'm going to start here next time, but I'm going to say just something a little bit about it. extrinsic regulation has to do with the baroreceptor reflex. And what, when you see this term baro or barometer, what's that? What is being measured there? Pressure. Like, have you ever listened to the weather report? Okay, and they tell you what? The barometric pressure. So you have barometers inside your body that are measuring pressure inside your blood vessels, and then it's going to require part of your brain to figure out if that pressure in your blood vessels is correct or not, and then if it's not correct, some changes have to be made in your body to bring it back down to normal. So next time we're going to start with the baroreceptor reflex, but at least you've kind of heard of it this time. Okay. All right, so we got to take a quiz. So please put all your books and everything on the floor. This is just individual effort. Don't look at your friends' papers, neighbors' papers. Don't look at your book. Anything written on the inside of your hats or eyeglasses, water bottles.